Last Sunday I was disgusting. Really, for about a week and a half, I just felt really, really terrible. And it was kind of a weird couple weeks because I was down and out for a week, just completely away. I was quarantined in my own house, so I was kind of in my bedroom all by myself and spent about a week that way. And then when I finally gradually began to come back to things this past week, I didn't want to be around anybody because I just wanted to make sure that I didn't pass off this plague to anybody else, because it was horrible. I've been watching for the entire winter how terrible the flu is, and mocked all these people. Come on, man, just suck it up and give. Man, it's bad. It's bad. Well, the last couple of weeks, it's given me a chance to think and reflect a little bit about what it is that I do all the weeks, day by day, week by week. I made this point before that it's always interesting when someone finds out I'm a minister, because they immediately look at you. They don't have a church background, or they're not common. The experience of church is not common to them. They look at you like, well, what do you do all the time? And I used to think that was kind of unique to ministers, that was like the one weird job. But I've come to realize that there's a lot of you have jobs that I have no idea what you do. Ruth Morrow, I have no idea what you do. I know that she goes to Honda every day. That's all I know. But beyond that, I have no idea. I know I have a pretty good idea of what Mike does, because he's got dirt under his fingernails, as he so poetically described all of us. Like, some jobs are pretty obvious. If you're a counselor, if you're a teacher, if you're a plumber. But there's a lot of jobs, as the economy has become so diverse and technology-based and service-based. There are a lot of jobs. If you're not in that industry, you have no idea what they do. And so a couple years ago on the Dilbert blog, a guy named Scott Adams challenged people to summarize their jobs in a sentence. And some of these are just pure gold. So I don't know how you might describe your job in a sentence. This person said, a lot of our young people will probably relate to this. My job is to read things that don't matter and then write papers arguing that they do matter for points that don't matter in order to get a job doing something totally unrelated. That would be the student. One person said, my job is to take numbers on pieces of paper, rearrange them, and then put them on different pieces of paper. That's probably a lot of your jobs. This person was a tax accountant. This person has a kind of a unique job that comes around in the summers. My job is to show you innovative ways to burn money in the spirit of patriotism. Someone who runs a fireworks stand. Some of you might relate to this if you're in a financial field. My job is to arrive after the battle and bayonet all the wounded. That's an auditor. Brian Ringley might relate to this. My job is to draw up plans for something that will not be built according to those plans. Civil engineer. This is one of my favorites. My job is to spend most of the day looking out the window. Oh, that's a pilot. go to strange people's houses and take their money. Pizza delivery boy. This one probably could relate to some of you. My job is to take pictures of the unlucky and the stupid. It's an x-ray technician. My job is to help people hate each other. Divorce attorneys. And one more. My job is to make people feel bad about their work. Quality assurance tester. You know, it's just kind of interesting to see different ways of considering what our jobs are. It's really nothing to do with work, but this week, as I was kind of thinking about our topic, I was thinking about Jesus getting ready to set out in his ministry and choose his disciples. And I wondered what the job description would look like if Jesus had posted in downtown Nazareth, hey, you know, we're looking for 12 fine good men, you know, and here's the description. I don't know what it was. I think it's one of the most underwhelming descriptions in the Bible. You know that Jesus chooses 12, only 12, and we don't really know anything about them. Like, you would think these are the cream of the crop. Like, you would expect these to be the best looking, the most successful, that he would go out into all the industries in the Near East there, and he would find the head honchos of each industry and say, hey, you've been successful. I want you to come be part of my band of believers. But instead, as we don't really get much about the whole process. But it's one of the most boring statements in all the Bible. In Matthew chapter 10, Jesus called his 12 disciples together, and he gave them authority to cast out evil spirits and to heal every kind of disease and illness. That's not boring. But then it just boringly lists them. Here's their names. First, Simon, also called Peter. Then Andrew, Peter's brother. James, son of Zebedee. John, James's brother. Philip, Bartholomew. Thomas, Matthew the tax collector. James, son of Alphaeus. Thaddeus, Simon the zealot. Judas Iscariot, who would later betray him. We talk about a disappointing list of people. I mean, imagine you had 12 people who in this day and age would pay millions of dollars to get that inside consultation. All right, you get to spend one-on-one time with Jesus Christ for 3 years. Anybody in any industry would give anything they could to do that. And here we have the list, and we're giving no criteria about these guys. They're nobodies. I mean, you know, today we'll be like, oh, he was voted, you know, he was on Forbes magazines, you know, leading 50 people, 50 great leaders under 40, whatever it is. They would give some kind of criteria for, hey, these were the real deal. Instead, we're not given much of anything. We know a little bit about Peter. We remember when Peter and Andrew were out casting nets and Jesus calls them. We're given that little insight into how they came about. But what about James? What about the Jameses? The son of Zebedee versus the son of Alphaeus. I have no idea the difference between them. That's just me. We know that Jesus loved John a lot, but we're really not given much of a description of what John was like. Philip has some kind of cool encounters in Acts, but we're not given any insight into his life at this point. Do you know anything about Bartholomew or Matthew or Thaddeus or Simon? I mean, there's all these people listed. They spent their most intimate moments with Jesus over these 3 years, and we don't really know anything about them. And yet, Matthew 19, verses 28 to 30, has this to say about them. Jesus replied, "I assure you that when the world is made new and the Son of Man sits upon his glorious throne, you who have been my followers also will sit on the 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And everyone who has given up houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or children or property for my sake will receive 100 times as much in return and will inherit eternal life. But many who are the greatest now will be the least important then. And those who seem least important now will be the greatest then." There's nothing about the description of these disciples to lend us to believe that these were the most important, powerful, smartest, best educated, best looking people that Jesus could get his hands on. And yet, Jesus tells them that they are going to have some kind of special role sitting on 12 thrones judging Israel. I've always found it to be one of the most remarkable things in the Bible that the Bible just doesn't seem to worry itself with letting us know more about these 12 apostles. Maybe there's some in church history that you can go back and you kind of learn a little bit more about them, but as far as the text itself, it doesn't give us any insight into why these 12, with the exception of Peter, who makes kind of a prominent appearance here or there in the Gospels, there's just not much we know about these apostles. There is one name, of course, that does stand out a little bit, and it's the last one. It's always the last one. 4 different times in the Gospels that the apostles are listed, 1 to 12, and his name is always the last. Judas. In our text in Matthew 10, his name is called Judas Iscariot. Iscariot is not his last name. Most people think that it's kind of a manipulation of a Latin word, sicarius, which was a word that meant murder or assassin. A lot of people believe that Judas was a part of a Jewish sect called the Sicarii. And the Sicarii were kind of the radicalized group of Jews. They were the ones that were ready, that they carried weapons around with them because they were always ready for a revolt. That in a drop of a hat, if somebody would come along and say, all right, let's win Israel back, then the Sicarii were always ready. And most people think that Judas was a member of that group. We don't really know much about Judas, even though he plays such a prominent role. And Mike read a little bit about the betrayal narrative. as important of a role as he plays in that. We don't know much about him. We're not given a backstory. We don't know that his parents beat him when he was a kid. We don't know where he went wrong, which is interesting that the Bible never really tells us. The only real insight we get is in John chapter 12, when Jesus' feet were being anointed using expensive perfume, and Judas Iscariot, the disciple who would pretty soon betray Jesus, said that perfume was worth a year's wages. It should have been sold and the money given to the poor. Not that he cared for the poor. He was a thief. And since he was in charge of the disciples' money, he often stole some of it for himself. Other than this small detail, and it's an unsavory one at that, but other than that small detail, Judas spent 3 years with Jesus that we don't know anything about. I mean, there's some collective things where the disciples were all sent out or all did this, but as far as Judas's backstory, we just don't really know much about him. We know that he was the treasurer and that he was skimming money off the top. Let's remind ourselves of Judas's treason in Matthew chapter 26, beginning in verse 14. Then Judas Iscariot, one of the 12 disciples, went to the leading priests and asked, "How much will you pay me to betray Jesus to you?" They gave him 30 pieces of silver. From that time on, Judas began looking for an opportunity to betray Jesus. On the first day of the festival of unleavened bread, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Where do you want us to prepare the Passover meal for you?" "As you go into the city," he told them, "you'll see a certain man. Tell him, 'The teacher says, my time has come. I'll eat the Passover meal with my disciples at your house.'" So the disciples did as Jesus told them and prepared the Passover meal there. When it was evening, Jesus sat down at the table with the 12. While they were eating, he said, "I tell you the truth, one of you will betray me." Greatly distressed, each one of them asked in turn, "Am I the one, Lord?" He replied, "One of you who has just eaten from this bowl with me will betray me. For the Son of Man must die, and the Scriptures declared long ago. But how terrible it will be for the one who betrays him. It should be far better than that man had never been born." Judas, the one who would betray him, asked also, "Rabbi, am I the one?" And Jesus told him, "You have said it." Matthew uses kind of an interesting device here. All the disciples are curious, "Am I the one who's going to betray you, Lord?" And they intentionally use the word Adonai, Lord, Kyrios in Greek. Judas is the one who at the end says, "Oh, not me." He doesn't say Lord, does he? He says Rabbi, teacher. Don't miss the point here. Judas saw Jesus as his teacher, but Lord of his life, I don't know if I want to go there. He begins to distance himself from Jesus here. He didn't want to be known as the one who betrayed him. But the seeds were there, as he is not my Lord. A little bit further on in verse 47, even as Jesus said this, Judas, one of the 12 disciples, arrived with a crowd of men armed with swords and clubs. They had been sent by the leading priests and elders of the people. The traitor, Judas, had given them a pre-arranged signal. "You will know which one to arrest when I greet him with a kiss." And so Judas came straight to Jesus. "Greetings, Rabbi." He calls him teacher again and gave him a kiss. Jesus said, "My friend, go ahead and do what you have come for us." Then the others grabbed Jesus and arrested. You know, we know this story so well. It gets to this point in the story. We wish we could press pause, don't we? Like, we just wish that as they're gathered around the table and they're preparing to eat the Last Supper together, that we could just pause it before Judas sells them out. We know that the things are already set in motion, that it's impossible to go back now. But it's just such a devastating moment to think of Jesus and the 12 closest people to him, and that one of them would betray him with a kiss. It's a scene that all of us can probably picture in our mind's eye if we close our eyes, and it doesn't ever get old. It doesn't ever neuter itself. The power, the significance of that moment is constantly there. And we're left this morning to ask the question, why would he do it? Like, why would Judas do it? Because if you focus only on the 30 pieces of silver, I think you're going to miss the point. Because we've already found out that he was already working as a treasurer. He was already skimming money off of the top. Any money issues that he might have been facing, he probably already had taken care of those. After all, he had kind of this gig set up that long term he was going to be okay. He just keeps skimming money off the top. Keep taking a little bit for himself. Surely 30 pieces of silver was a big chunk of change, but it wasn't better than a long-term embezzlement scheme, which is what he had going on. I want to suggest to you that there's another reason why Judas did this. A lot of scholars believe that Judas really didn't have much to do with the silver, that Judas was actually trying to prompt Jesus to get on with things, that he was tired of waiting, that he was growing impatient for Jesus to take back Israel from the Roman occupation. And so he tries to force his hand a little bit. Remember, he's a member of the Sicarii Jewish sect. We would call them radicalized today in our terminology. They're ready to fight at the drop of a hat, carrying weapons around with them all the time. And Judas was enamored with his rabbi. He was enamored with his teacher. He was ready to follow him. But he was getting tired of waiting. So often we read the story of Judas, and we think to ourselves, how could anyone ever do that? He's the worst apostle. He's the worst person that's ever lived. The text said it would have been better if he wouldn't have been born. There aren't very many times that the Bible makes that claim. The theologian Stanley Hauerwas makes this observation in his gospel, on his commentary on Matthew. How Matthew tells the story of Jesus indicates that knowing this story is not sufficient to make one a disciple, a faithful disciple. We must learn how we, like the disciples, would be tempted to betray Jesus, and from that lesson, discover what it means to be a faithful church. It's easy to lament who Judas is. Like, there aren't a lot of little baby Judases running around. Nobody really wants to name their kid after that disciple. There's probably some around there. Sorry to your cousin Judas or whatever, but most of us, Bathsheba and Judas, we try to, you know, there's not a lot of those that we name, our kids. It's easy to read the story and just dismiss him and think, oh, well, there's nothing for me to learn in Judas because I would never betray Jesus. And of course, that's the first step down the road of betrayal, isn't it? It's the first moment when we say, oh, that would never happen to me. I would never do that. And maybe it's because we live in one of the wealthiest nations in the world that we think, why would you ever betray the Savior for money? Because most of us are pretty comfortable. Most of us are living our lives okay. Even those of us who struggle the most, struggle would probably be not a real good word to use. We're doing okay. We were in a society that was destitute. It was fighting back. You know, when people don't have food to eat, water to drink, drastic things will happen. But there are other things, perhaps, that we would betray our Lord for. A beautiful woman or a striking gentleman that tickles our fancy or forces us to reconsider what God teaches us about love and marriage. Our obsession with being liked, being noticed, being popular might lead us to sell out for more of our dignity and privacy than we would have ever considered in the past. Our culture sells good times, incredible experiences, and the best of feelings, from plastic surgery to world travel to concerts to movies to sports. And it's easy to allow those things to intoxicate us, and we begin to tell ourselves, how could I ever have time for God? How could I ever find time to pray? How could I ever find time to be a robust part of my church? There are too many things to do, too many directions I'm being pulled. How can we ever find time for all those pleasures and still keep a robust faith? Maybe the temptations of Judas aren't quite as far afield as we might think they are. Or maybe we're just like Judas more than we want to admit. When gun violence becomes just kind of the norm in our culture, shootings become old hats. We begin to buy into the lies of violence and say, well, maybe that is the answer. even though we serve the Prince of Peace. Like Judas, we begin to call into question everything that Jesus taught because, well, desperate times call for desperate measures. We should remind ourselves the end of Judas's life in Matthew chapter 27. Very early in the morning, the leading priests and the elders of the people met again to lay plans for putting Jesus to death. Then they bound him, they led him away, and they took him to Pilate, the Roman governor. When Judas, who had betrayed him, realized that Jesus had been condemned to die, he was filled with remorse. It was beginning to settle in. Maybe this wasn't what Judas had in mind. So he took the 30 pieces of silver back to the leading priests and the elders. "I have sinned," he declared, "for I have betrayed an innocent man." "What do we care?" they retorted. "That's your problem." When Judas threw the silver coins down in the temple, and then he went out and he hanged himself. The leading priests picked up the coins. "It wouldn't be right to put this money in the temple treasury," they said, "since it was payment for murder." Oh, now they have a conscience. After some discussion, they finally decided to buy the potter's field, and they made it into a cemetery for foreigners. That's why the field is still called the Field of Blood. This fulfilled the prophecy of Jeremiah that says they took 30 pieces of silver, the price at which he was valued by the people of Israel, and purchased the potter's field, as the Lord declared. This haunting tale of Judas, one of only 12 disciples, should force us humbly to consider our relationship with Jesus. We should just not so quickly dismiss Judas and say, "I would never do that." He was one of the 12 apostles within the closest confines of Jesus Christ himself. And somewhere along the line, Satan crept into his heart. That earlier when Jesus was talking to the disciples and said, "Hey, each one of you 12 are going to be sitting on 12 thrones," he was talking to Judas. He was telling Judas, "There's so much that we have in store for you." It's just like the message of the entire Bible, that God is telling each of us, "I have so much in store for you. I have so much beauty and wonder and glory and forgiveness," and yet it's difficult to stay the course sometimes. It's human nature to look for shortcuts, to second guess, to wonder in the midst of things that seem impossible to overcome, that Christ continues to give us that beckoning. Just trust me. Trust me, if you've confessed me as Lord of your life, you will overcome. You will overcome. That our heart could grow cold and our patience would run thin, our life could be distracted. Any of these things can happen to us. Lent is the opportunity, it's the time, it's the moment to reflect on our faith and specifically on our sin. It's easy to put ourselves next to a murderer, or a mass murderer, or the worst of the worst, and think better about ourselves, which is what we usually do. But there's a parable about that, of course. Dear Lord, thank you that I'm not like that murdering, terrible sinner over there. That the one who went home justified was the one that said, "Have mercy on me, a sinner." On our board, we're going to fill it with lots of great champions of faith. We've already seen several, John the Baptist, Isaiah. And all year long, Judas is going to glow up there. And all year long, we're going to catch a glimpse of that. We're going to remember our study of Judas. We're going to be reminded of the fact that even among the 12, there was sin. There was difficulty. That sin is ever on our doorstep. No matter how old we get, no matter what circumstances our life might confront, sin is always at our doorstep. And we have to beckon in the Holy Spirit to sanctify us, to justify us, to continue to cleanse us. And that can only happen when we open ourselves to Him. If Judas can fall, then any of us can fall. And I don't know that Judas ever just decided one day that he was going to betray Jesus. I think slowly it crept into his life. Slowly he began to look more to the dark side and to Satan and his guidance than he did to Jesus. He began to discount Jesus as his Lord and just begin to appreciate Him only as a teacher. The question before us as we end this morning is Jesus only our teacher, or is He Lord of our life? We're going to end with this pretty powerful song as we ask questions about if it hadn't been for God. I'd invite you to stand and sing with us this morning.